Okay, we're almost at 2. Oh, my clocks don't agree. Okay, one clock says it's 3 after, the other one says it's 3 of. Therefore, on average, it is 2 o'clock. I am not going to spend... Did anybody watch the Oscars last month? It was a great moment, I think. Yeah, the host was miserable, but it was a great moment when he said, the next guest here needs no introduction. And then he walked off the stage. It was fantastic. I'm going to do something like that, basically. I'm not going to bore you with a long bio. I'm sure these are very, very impressive people, but I'm going to let them introduce themselves. So, without any further ado, Darryl Mann.
Great. Thank you very much. And great to be here, everybody. Thanks for coming. So, I thought I'd give... a short summary of some of the work that we've been doing with some of our clients, mainly in the fast-moving consumer goods space. One of the big ideas behind what my company does is someone somewhere has solved your problem. So very closely aligned, I think, to the knowledge management community, at least in theory, someone somewhere solved your problem. Whatever it is you're trying to do, somebody out there has had a version of that problem. But how do I go and connect to that person or those persons? And one of the key challenges, I think, is when we're trying to innovate. Experience, I think, tells us, and the statistics will tell us, that most attempts to innovate will end in failure. So go and learn from the people that are successful. And one of the key contributors to that success, and the focus of what I'm going to talk about, is understanding what the customer actually wanted. So let's just quickly reflect on what I mean by innovation statistics. So this is what the CEO of an organization tends to see. And so the first mistake on this picture is on the horizontal axis, on the x-axis, we're equating innovation to R&D. So as a fraction of my sales, how much did I spend on R&D? Now, increasingly, I think innovation has got nothing to do with technology, it's got nothing to do with R&D, but if we use that as a measure, and then we think about, okay, well, how much of that investment turned into value for my organization? So the vertical axis is the growth of my organization, and each of the blue dots is an organization. If you tried to draw the average through those blue dots, I think you would have to conclude it really doesn't matter how much you spend on R&D, the net impact on the growth of your company is going to be zero. Okay. CEOs look at pictures like that and say innovation equals risk equals if I can possibly avoid innovating, that's what I should do. There is, however, some useful information in here, I think. So when I look at a picture like that, I say to myself, okay, well, what did Apple do that the other companies on there did not do? Yeah, was it dumb luck, or was there something ingrained in the way the organization worked that allowed them to achieve a much greater success rate? If we try and break down the reasons for failure in innovation attempts, the number to keep in your mind, global average right now, is about 98% of innovation attempts are going to end in failure. In other words, I'm going to lose my money. Why? This picture here breaks the world down into 5 different segments. And the biggest of those segments is that innovation attempt failed because the management team was incapable of coordinating all of the activities that needed to happen. In my mind, innovation is one of the most difficult jobs there is going, and it's a very cruel job. What it says is, if there are 100 things I need to do to get from where I am today to the money at the end of the project, then if I get any one of those 100 things wrong, I've just lost my money. So I need a very robust system, and that picture there, and particularly the coordination part of it, is saying that we're just not robust enough. The management teams are not able to get all of those things in the right place at the right time in order to turn the idea into money. That's not the thing I'm going to focus on this afternoon. The thing I am going to focus on is on the top left of the picture, and that says about a quarter of innovation attempts are going to go wrong because we just solved the wrong problem. Okay. We either didn't understand the customer or we misinterpreted what the customer told us that they wanted. So Here's another way of looking at that same picture. Innovation, for me, is the intersection of those three bubbles there. Yeah. Successfully getting to the money at the end of a project, the value at the end of the project says, I needed to understand what the customer wanted. I needed to deliver and create the right solution for that challenge, preferably in a protectable way. And at the bottom, my organisation needs to be capable of executing the idea. And it's only when I get all three of those things right that I've got a chance of recouping my investment. So as I said, I'm going to focus on the customer need part of the story. And here's, I think, a key part of the challenge. Why is this job so difficult? Why is it so difficult to understand what the customer is trying to tell us? So this is the classic British restaurant. Those of you that spent any time at all in the UK will know we've got the worst food on the planet. But the waiters in restaurants have now been taught that it's a good idea to go up to the diner and ask them if they've enjoyed the meal. So that's what's happening on the left-hand side of the picture. And the diner, who's undoubtedly had a bad experience, is not going to tell that to the waiter for various reasons. In the UK, some people are still quite polite, and so we will tell the waiter, everything was lovely, the meal was great, thank you. All the time, we're thinking, I'm never going to come back to this restaurant ever again. Okay. So part of the challenge of understanding customer need is trying to get that thought bubble, trying to understand what's happening inside the person's head rather than hearing the words that are coming out of their mouth. Okay. So how do I capture that information? Because if we're thinking about knowledge management, for me, the real knowledge is the stuff that's being thought about, not the stuff that's being said. Now, in our journey, my company, we're a small organisation, so there are 45 of us. The thing that we've had going for us, I call it luck, and it probably is luck, is clients that have asked us some great questions and have given us the time to go and explore how best to answer those questions. So back in the year 2000, we were working with the marketing people inside General Motors in the United States. And talk about knowledge management. There's a part of the business where they had 40 people full-time listening to consumers in the United States, surveying consumers, looking at market trends, looking at societal trends, literally creating a mountain of knowledge, at the end of which everybody said, we have no idea how to design a car that will resonate with what the customer wants. Yeah, in other words, we'll produce mediocre cars. So help us to understand why that is and what we can do about it. Okay? And in their words, how do I understand the consumer without going to ask the consumer? Okay, now, we love impossible questions like that, so we were very fortunate to have 4 years working with them to answer it, and even more fortunate that I'm allowed to share some of what we learned with you. Lucky moment number two was 2004, when we started working with Procter & Gamble in the United States. And they saw what we'd been doing with General Motors and said, that's really interesting, but our problem's a little bit different. In our world, things change very, very quickly indeed. And so in our world, if you've spotted a trend, a consumer trend, a market trend, by the time you've got your product designed and to the market, you're too late. Yeah, because the trend's already there. And you're seen as being too late. So our challenge is, how do I find the trends before they've become trends? Yeah. And again, we love those kind of impossible questions, so we spent a number of years working with them to try and find answers to those challenges. So a few clues, a few of the things that have come out of that research. So here's one way of thinking about this is a hierarchy of stuff that I can go and measure. If the source of knowledge is I go and measure something, then what do I go and measure? And down at the bottom of the pyramid are the things that we see organisations will typically go and measure. You know, the easy stuff. If I'm thinking about a call centre, for example, how many calls came into the call centre? How quickly did I answer those calls? Next level up, the interactions. Did the consumer, the customer at the other end of the line, sound happy, for example? Yeah. I can do surveys of customers to work out, was the interaction satisfactory as far as the person was concerned? But the top two levels, as we get further up, it's more and more difficult to measure that kind of stuff. So did the customer get the outcome that they wanted at the end of the process? Much more difficult to measure. And even higher than that, why did the customer call in the first place? And did you tap into the underlying meaning behind that interaction with the customer? So part of the thinking with the General Motors project, with the Procter & Gamble project, was how do I capture the outcome stuff and the meaning stuff, which is the things that we believe drive the behaviour of people. So let's just think about the outcome part. So the third part up that hierarchy. And reflect a little bit on Apple and Steve Jobs. And we heard at the start of the session today the idea of, you know, why did Steve Jobs think that he did not have to go and ask the customer? Yeah. Was that arrogance on his part? Was it dumb luck again? Or was there some underpinning methodology? My proposal would be very definitely an underpinning methodology. I never met Steve Jobs. We work with quite a few of his designers these days. And one of the things they've got very clearly understood inside the organisation is make sure you understand the outcomes that your customer is looking to achieve. Okay. And by the way, in order to understand outcomes, you do not need to go and ask the customer. Okay. There just aren't that many outcomes that any of us in life are trying to achieve. Slight complication in the story is that some of those outcomes are very tangible. Yeah, I wear a watch because I want to tell the time. Yeah, but there are also clear intangible needs. I wear a watch, or I not wear a watch, for the reasons of fashion, status, lack of status, whatever it is. But tangible reasons and intangible reasons are things that drive behaviour. So if I just divide the world in this very simple way here, I can look at outcomes that the customer wants, tangible, intangible. But then looking at the vertical axis, there are outcomes that relate to me personally, but then also outcomes that relate to the people around me, the we part of the story. So here's a something that's become mantra inside Procter & Gamble, I would say, certainly in the United States. A recognition that what drives people's behaviour is we do things for a good reason and a real reason. The good reason is the stuff that we will be very happy to talk to other people about. And when you do a customer survey, you'll get all of that good reason stuff. But it's very difficult to elicit the real reason stuff. So here's Tony Fadell. So if you're an Apple fan, Tony Fadell was the brains behind iPod. And we were very fortunate working with Tony at the start of his latest venture. So he's earned all of the money that he ever needs to earn, but is still committed to making a difference. So he knew that his next project was going to work in a certain direction. And so right at the start of the project, all we had was that phrase there. He knew that there was a need within the market for what he called an eco badge. Now, if you think about what happens in terms of product development or service development in any of your organisations, I think it would be pretty unusual, and you'd be a pretty brave person to start with something as intangible as that. You'd very typically want to start with a product, yeah, or the service. Yeah. Yet we design mobile phones. Yeah. Tony Fadell had no idea what the product was going to be. Yeah. Just a recognition that what the market was looking for was this intangible eco badge. And the idea behind an eco badge, if we expand that out a little bit, is give people a sign that they could put on their house, for example, or on their shirt lapel that says, I care about the environment. Okay. But what he also recognised was that if you survey people, 95% of people will say, yes, I care about the environment. Okay. If you look at people's behaviour, about 5% of people will actually do something to demonstrate they care about the environment. Okay. So there's a massive mismatch between what we say and what we do. Okay. He recognized that mismatch and said, okay, people feel actually guilty about that failure to do something about their feelings about the environment. So it needs to be something that actually removes some guilt. So I can demonstrate to other people that I care. It removes my guilt. But at the same time, on the left-hand side of the picture, it has also to deliver a tangible benefit. People do things for a good reason and a real reason. And so part of that making a difference from a tangible perspective was to save energy. Okay. And that was the first clue towards what was the product going to be. But we're now 3 months into the project and we still don't know what the product is. Okay. And it was only another couple of months after that that we knew that it was going to be a thermostat for your heating and cooling system in your house. So some of you may have seen Nest. Nest is the new company. And there's a product that you can see that's got the characteristics of an Apple-type product. Very, very simple. It's got one button on it. It's literally the control system for your temperature system inside your home. The reason it saves money is because it's an intelligent control system. Once we knew what the unspoken need was and where the focus should be tangibly, it was then simply just a case of bolting together existing technologies. Yeah. Again, Apple is very, very good at saying, I don't need to reinvent the world. Someone somewhere solved all of my problems. It's a case of finding the right combination of stuff for the market need at the moment. So understanding the outcome is one thing. Trying to dig a little bit deeper then. This is some research done by a couple of gentlemen who are no longer with us. But again, people who try to understand the psychology and the mentality of people, and particularly thinking about us as customers. And I think one of the things that comes out of both of those pieces of research is that the way that we uncover customer needs is much more like the left-hand side of the picture than it is the right-hand side of the picture. Yeah, it's a detective job. We're trying to uncover clues. And so the thought that we might be able to deliver a step one, step two, step three, step four process is pretty naive. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. So build processes that allow you to do that clue gathering exercise. So I thought I'd just show you one or two of the things that we would use with clients to try and understand and collect these clues as to what is driving people's behavior. So the first one, this is a complicated picture, but hopefully says some fairly simple things. This is looking at generational differences. And so if you look around your society and some of the friends, some of the colleagues that you work with, I'm sure you've spotted that there are generational differences in that Generation Y, for example, is different from the baby boomer generation in the West. So what are those differences and where do they come from? In many ways a very fuzzy pattern. We can see the differences, but if you try and prod and dig into what are those differences specifically, it's difficult to do that. So what I have tried to do here is to look at those differences and exaggerate them. Okay, so there is no way that you can summarize a whole generation in one word. Okay, but if I look at the average characteristics and then go to the extremes and look at the outliers of those things, then I can get what I think is quite an interesting pattern. Okay, so this picture here, on the horizontal axis is calendar year, and then the vertical axis is year of a person. So one of the ways of using this picture is if you identify the year that you were born on the horizontal axis. So I was born 1962, so I'm right on this diagonal line here. So in 1982, I'm 20 years old. And so if you wanted to get a snapshot perspective of who is Daryl, then I actually fell just on this side, so I'm the green person. So as a child, I was an abandoned child. What that meant was that my mother and my father both worked. So when I came home from school, I had to look after myself. Okay. An abandoned child grows up to be an alienated adult. So whatever the government tells me and whatever my boss tells me, I automatically think something else. I don't believe them. Yeah, I'm going to do the opposite of what I'm told to do. But when I become a parent, then the children that I raise, this next generation, I will be very protective of those people, of those children. Okay, so a Generation Y person. And if you're born in China, for example, under the one-child policy, you have the strawberry generation, very, very protected. Yeah, that protected person grows up to have certain characteristics, heroic. And so I think Generation Y is right now a very heroic generation. Now, what that means in the UK is anything that I do, I'm going to do in a very heroic way. Okay, so if I'm going to go drinking on a Friday night, I'm going to drink heroically until I fall down. Yeah. If I'm going to get a tattoo, then I'm going to have my whole arm tattooed, because that's what a hero would do. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean everybody's going to do it, but what it means is that there's a theme behind what people tend to do, and what I'm trying to do is to exaggerate the difference. And the reason I'm trying to exaggerate the difference is what I'm looking for from an innovation perspective is contradiction. Where I can spot difference, then my opportunity as an innovator is to find a solution which successfully solves that contradiction. Okay. So recognizing, for example, that my customers span different generations tells me there are contradictions. And therefore, if I'm trying to design a product that will make them both happy, it's my job now to solve that contradiction. Okay, so let's, this is a piece of research that we did. I've left this slide in the notes. So if any of you are interested in China history, then when we tried to reproduce the research that I've showed you, our first hypothesis was, surely this cannot apply in China. And 2 years later, working with a number of universities on the mainland, the pattern is exactly the same. There are subtle differences in terms of when the flip-over points between one generation and the next are, but absolutely the pattern is there. Yeah. But beyond the pattern, the important idea is this contradiction idea again. Once I know where my customer is on that picture, then if it spans different generations at different times, for example, my job as an innovator is to solve that contradiction. Okay, let's just do one final thing, just thinking about patterns and understanding customer. I mentioned the idea of a customer trend and market trends. And if you work for a large organization, I'm sure there are people inside your organization whose job is to kind of collect this stuff here. And what we tried to do with that information, I hope that's the worst slide that we'll see this afternoon. Actually, it won't, because I've got another one that's worse in a second. But what's happening here is each of those ovals represents a trend, a customer trend, a market trend. And so one of the things we were trying to do was to understand how do these trends relate to one another. And as we were doing that job, we began to realize something important. And the important fact was not so much the trends themselves, but the relationship between the trends. What drives innovation success and what drives customer need is relationship between trends. So all the stuff and all the information that companies have been collecting in terms of trends and behaviors, wonderful. We've just been using it in the wrong way. It's not the trends, it's the relationship between the trends that drives behavior. And what we're really looking for in those relationships between trends is when one trend conflicts with another trend. Okay. If you can find those situations and your product or your service successfully then solves that conflict, you've just made a lot of people very happy. Yeah, one trend blocks the other trend. And so if you unblock that trend, then you allow it to continue and you allow it to expand. Okay, and there's your new market. So where do new trends come from? New trends come from products and services that successfully solve those conflicts. Okay, so understanding the customer need, in my terms, means predominantly the job of finding the contradictions and the conflicts in society. Once you've done that, just as a final thought, then you can start tapping into the knowledge of the rest of the planet in terms of how other people have solved similar conflicts and contradictions. So here is my worst slide. There's about 3.5 million data points on there, so that probably explains why it's mostly not readable. But that's a tool that says, if you can find these contradictions, and then look at how other people in other domains have solved those sorts of problems, then what we see very, very clearly is we're all using the same basic strategies to solve the problems. Okay? There just aren't that many ways of solving a contradiction once you've found them. If any of you have heard of TRIZ, an old Russian problem-solving methodology, TRIZ would say there are 40 ways to solve a contradiction. Yeah. I've been paying my research team for the last 17 years to find more strategies for solving contradictions, and for those 17 years they have completely failed. We still only have 40 ways to solve a contradiction. Okay. And what's happening in that table is at the intersection of a row and a column is a box with a series of numbers in it. Those numbers relate to the strategies, those 40 principles that other people have used to solve your problem. So if I take the Tony Fadell Nest problem, I want to reduce energy consumption, but the customer's too lazy to actually do anything, then I'm not the only person in the world who's had that problem before. Yeah, all I need to do is to tap into what other people have done before me, is work out how to map my problem onto that table and understand the numbers at the end, those numbers being the strategies that other people have used to solve the similar problem. So when I think about knowledge management, and when I think about knowledge management with my clients, this is the knowledge management tool. This is the important stuff. If innovation pretty much boils down to solving contradictions, then the knowledge we should be collecting is how other people have done that for us already. Yeah. And suddenly, the enormous, or apparently enormous, world of knowledge management, for me, distills down to a sheet of A3 paper. Yeah. There just aren't that many ways of solving these difficult contradiction problems. It's very counterintuitive, and I think when I've tried to talk at knowledge management events previously, very, very counterintuitive. How can it possibly be? But yeah, time and time we see it. 3.5 million is the number we've got on the top of that picture there. Go and look at people who've done the innovation job. Work out what problem they've tried to solve. And there just aren't that many problems. We can measure the problems in hundreds. And then at the bottom, there just aren't that many ways of solving the problem well. Yeah, now, all I'm hoping to do this afternoon, just thinking about that slide there, is intrigue you. Yeah, I can't possibly prove to you that that's the case, but what I can suggest is, if we contemplate if that is true, how does that change the way that we think about knowledge and the way that we think about solving problems inside our organisations? Yeah. The best evidence I can give you in terms of people using that would be Samsung. Samsung is probably the world's biggest user of these tools here. Now, I don't know what your opinion of Samsung is, but I imagine over the last 5 years, it has changed. Yeah, a company that's come from being a long way behind to being a pioneer in pretty much every environment that they operate in. A number to keep in mind is right now, Samsung is averaging about 160 patents per week being granted. Yeah. How do I do that? I teach 15,000 people inside my organization that there just aren't that many ways to solve problems effectively. Yeah. That's real knowledge management, I think. So, big thank you for the invitation. Thank you for your attention. And if there are any questions, are we taking them now or later on?
It's panel at the end.
Panel at the end. Okay. Thank you very much for the invitation.